Hello and welcome to another episode of Why Press Play. This time we're going back to 1979. And joining us in the studio is former iRadio and Spin Breakfast Morning Show legend, stand-up comedian from Dublin, and current proprietor of the Project 10 podcast. Yo. That you can find anywhere online.
Proprietor? That sounds very fancy. Far too fancy than what it actually is, Gordon.
Yeah, take off that bow tie. We have Cormac Moore in the studio. How are you going, Cormac?
Good, man. Thank you very much for having us.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. So this is your choice. We're doing Super 8 today, the J.J. Abrams kid classic horror monster movie from 2011. And you chose this from the annals. Is that how you pronounce that? From the annals of your mind.
What, the Super 8?
Super 8,
And because I only watched it recently.
Right.
And it had been one of those movies where I had been constantly scanning over it and kind of going, meh, whatever.
The cover doesn't say much.
It doesn't say anything at all. Mm. So I kind of looked at it and the name Super 8, I was just like, it meant nothing to me. Yeah. So Netflix kept going, you're going to love this. And I was like, shut up, Netflix.
Stop it, Netflix, yeah, with your thumbs up and thumbs down.
Yeah, and your algorithm fucking knowing me better than I know myself.
Amy Schumer, what a cunt. So she ruined it for everybody. So like, Super 8, as you're looking at the cover, and this is kind of like the epitome of what White Press Play tries to do,
right,
is go like, look past a recommendation from an algorithm, from a computer's brain, and go like, this is actually something you should watch. Don't ignore this if it pops up in your feed. I think it is on Netflix.
It is
now.
That's where I saw it, yeah. And this is going to be taken away soon.
No, I think it's just went up for the new October thing. We will have on the website in the future. The website is not live at the moment, but we will have what's coming on and what's going off on Netflix, including movies and TV shows. Yeah. They do like a monthly roundup. But this one is definitely, get onto it. Beautiful movie. Has like overtones of E.T., The Goonies.
Yeah.
There's especially like with It coming out in the cinema now recently, there's like a whole bunch of kids going off on an adventure. With a monster at the start of it. Something like Stranger Things as well is huge.
That's it. They're kind of gone for this 80s nostalgia buzz. Now, yeah. I know it's 1979 it's set in, but it's still pretty much the same.
Yeah.
Now, I hope that there isn't going to be overkill, because it came out very similar style. Stranger Things, which I loved, very, very similar style, even in how it's shot and how it's filmed and the storyline. But Super 8... nudges into that category of, as I said, E.T. versus the Coonies versus something crazy.
But like most of the other stuff, though, that J.J. Abrams does, this was cool before it was cool. He is a bit of a visionary. We'll suck all over his knob in about 25 minutes or half an hour. But like nowadays, all the stuff from the 80s is pure like back in style. The National Health glasses and the check shirts, the Ben Shermans and... all the
unemployment.
Unemployment, fear of communism,
there
all this
you go.
Kind of
Actually,
stuff.
Actually, we are back in the 80s, aren't we?
It is, yeah.
We're in a bit of a Cold War now with North Korea.
The Russians are coming. Yeah, it just seems...
communism, yeah.
but like, it just seems that like J.J. Abrams had his finger on the pulse back then. It was kind of like, as he says himself, a love letter to the Steven Spielberg movies of the early 70s.
And Spielberg produced it as well, which I found out recently.
Is J.J. Abrams the second coming of Christ?
And Abrams used to redevelop Super 8 or convert Super 8 films for Spielberg? Or is that the... Yeah, I'm pretty sure I read that as well.
In a workshop.
Yeah.
And Steven Spielberg came down to him and went, "You, my son... You are the best worker with the film. Come, I will show you the secrets." And he over every digital copy of the films, they say this like magic incantation, and then it just shoots to the top of the charts in the movie box office.
Instead of Mecca, they have to point to IMDb at 6 o'clock every around and go, "Hey, Rotten Tomatoes.
I will teach you the secret to make hit movies, no matter about whatever it is about." This is Steven Spielberg.
Spielbergo.
No matter whatever it is about. You can have it be about children chasing a monster, or indeed a totally revamped and redone stalwart science fiction property. You can do it and no one will care.
And then it'll be a 30-year montage of training up in the mountains with the Buddhist monk who is Steven Spielberg.
Like
and
Batman it's like, Begins.
I think so, yeah. Abrams Begins could be a new kind of version. I like where we're going with this. We should write this down and pitch it
definitely,
in.
Definitely. I want to see J.J. Abrams' biopic, how that happens. He just comes down where he's like slaving in the film mines, digging up all
the
film.
It'd be so weird if it was exactly how you described it. 4 hours of, "Hey, my son, you come and do the movie.
Let me tell you." It's not a Jewish voice that I'm doing at all, Spielberg. If you're listening, Steve, I guess hi, get in touch. We'd love to talk.
Yeah, come on the show.
I will hopefully at some point run into JJ Abrams. I'm going to be stalking him around LA when I go to America for those conspiracy guys. Like, there's not much you can say about how good he is without sounding like you're licking his hole.
Yeah.
But the stuff that he's put into this film, particularly because this was his first official written, produced, directed solo kind of, but like...
He had a lot of control over it.
Yeah, it wasn't a reboot, or it wasn't an already existing property, or it wasn't a sequel, or it wasn't, you know, he had done TV, but like high level TV in the age of peak TV, and in 2011, which is 6 years ago now, kids. That's a long time in future land.
It definitely is. And see, I was kind of annoyed when I was watching it because I dissed it so much. I didn't bother my whole ever watching. I was annoyed that it'd take me so many years to bother to sit down and watch it because it was so good.
The same with Cloverfield. One of those ones. And then Cloverfield Lane kind of, I didn't think was great. And it cast kind of a shadow over the first one, which is just CGI, shaky cam, Blair Witch Project goodness. It's just mad crack. And we will be doing that later on White Press Play as well. But with Super 8 on the horizon, we just want to talk to Cormac and get to find out what he does when he's at home in his jocks. Cormac, you do a podcast called Project 10.
Yeah, we'll leave out what I do in my jocks out of this just for the concern and the safety.
That's how I make this show, is that not?
Yeah, I know, you'd put some pants on.
I only had to put on pants when you fucking came here.
I do a podcast called Project 10. It's a 10-part kind of documentary style series.
It's nothing to do with Jake Paul or any of those guys.
No.
From Team 10.
No, and right. Do you know what else funny I found out? Project 10, was the hardest part of the whole series was coming up with the name, right? And then it's not that creative. I wanted to do a 10-part series, and I was trying to come up with all these cool names, like something like Vice or something that would capture what I'm trying to do, you know? And I couldn't in the end, so it was just like Project 10 kind of somewhat explains kind of what it is, so we'll just go with that.
I think it fits. Like, you have to have... I think a lot of people have these infinity episode podcasts.
Yeah.
That don't really fit into any structural narrative, which is beneficial in loads of ways. It means you can drop in and just start listening and you haven't missed anything.
Mm.
Or if it's like serialized, like Serial or, you know, S-Town or Missing Maura Murray or any of these ones that have a start and an end.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a structured narrative broken up into parts, like as it would be with like The Keepers on Netflix or any of those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The way that... I think podcasts kind of work better as if there is some kind of a loose structural narrative or some kind of overarching. And whenever you hear like lads going into TV stations when they're changing over from YouTube, they always get a producer's like, okay guys, what's the overarching narrative? I mean, what's the hook?
What's the slug line on this?
And you have to like build this thing, be it natural or artificial, you have to build it in because it just works better with the human head. So with those conspiracy guys, I know that we put them into 14 episode seasons.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You get the BBC style, which is 6 episode seasons. Yeah. And then the American network, which is like 23, 24, 25 episodes. Yeah. You get like a feature length 24, 25 double episode at the end, like the way Lost was done or any of these ones. And I think that podcasting kind of between 10 and 14 is a really nice, comfortable amount and to say like this is a season and they can all have some kind of link, like a throughput.
And the reason I was doing it that way as well was one, to give myself some sort of end point so I would know to focus on 10 and we'll do. And it was kind of a good way to get rid of a lot of the fluff as well. So you have, let's say you might have 20 topics, but what are the ones that are most interesting to you that you might think might be easily done and just chop them down?
Yeah, so as your show goes on, it's going to get more and more boring.
Exactly, yeah.
Because they're going to be the ones that you didn't want to do in the first 10.
You're going to front load the first 3. You'll be like, these are amazing. The rest, I hate this.
And once they're in, sure, the people are fans for life.
Yeah, and then I'm thinking, you know, if there's going to be, obviously you do it as 10 if it goes well, which it has so far, thankfully.
Yeah.
You know, you'll know whether or not to keep going or whether to bin it and go get a job.
Well, you know, at the end of September now, at the time of recording, you have, is it your third episode released this week?
Not released this week. It's currently,
it's on the way.
It's on the way.
Okay.
So I've been annoying people. I have the first couple of interviews done and just waiting for other people to get back to me and wrap it up. But it's mad because for the first time this episode, I know the structure of the episode now in my head.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for people to fill in what I think will be really interesting.
You do podcasting like Michelangelo does statues. You see a block of granite and you're just like letting the statue come out of the rock rather than making the rock into a statue.
There you go.
I love it.
I lock people in stone it's and good. Go, it's from my podcast.
Podcast Michelangelo. But you come from a radio background. So, I mean, it is high production. I've heard that the second episode I only listened to, which is about influencers, which is just like, mwah, kiss you on the butthole. It's scathing, but at the same time, it's constructive. And you have a kind of a commentary on how society is in general. And that's what we try to do as well with those conspiracy guys, is take a topic. Like, I always use this as an example, like the Marilyn Monroe episode. People listen to that expecting, like, the gory details of her getting drugs poured up her arse by the mafia or whatever. But what we really did was talk about, like, women in media during the 40s and 50s when it was tough. We talk about like suicide, we talk about mental health, we talk about sexual abuse and all of those things she suffered along the way. And you know, the last half hour is like, ah yeah, and all the stuff you saw in the movies, like,
and here's the gore you're waiting for.
But it like, I see the way you're doing it. It's more of a social commentary rather than just like, here's the facts, make up your own mind. You do put a bit of schmacked on it, and it's kind of outside of your radio remit, which was restrictively unbiased.
Oh, completely. And like, from commercial radio that was owned by, not even, I don't even say owned by a billionaire. The problem with radio, or not the
is
problem,
fucking lawsuits is the problem with radio. Lawsuits, you say anything about any cunt.
But not even lawsuits, is that obviously I was working for a commercial music radio, a youth radio station, right? So when I initially started off, I was doing a late night slot, which I could do more of this kind of content and had much more freedom to talk about more serious, controversial, but a wider range of subjects.
Because people don't get pissed off at nighttime as easy as to do first thing in the morning.
And you're far more, you'll consume more at nighttime, as the saying goes, because you're more, you're not as busy or hectic trying to get to work. You're winding down, so you listen more. But when you're doing breakfast radio, it's very formatted, it's very rigid, and you haven't got the freedom to have a 20-minute conversation with someone.
Sure, you have to be lashing in news, weather, and music.
And traffic, and music, traffic, and all that shit. Yeah. And it's mad because you're licensed, you have to play, our license was you had to play a certain amount of music per hour. You had to have a certain amount of news per hour. You
three
had
to hits, have, back to back.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So the problem with that is, and obviously you've a different audience in the morning, which are children in the car, so you can't curse,
you can't even make like non-curse word allusions to sexual behavior, or
I couldn't say pissed off.
Yeah,
so you're getting abused for saying pissed off, and you can't mention alcohol on the air in Ireland before 12 o'clock midday.
Damn.
So if you even say I went there for a drink last night, you could get you could technically have the station lose their license. You know what I mean, to take it that seriously. So it's very restrictive, and that's why I think podcasting is a lot better, because you can do what you want. And rather than reporting on the Kardashians, which a lot of the station was about, or celebrity reality culture, which I think people are getting fed up with now, I wanted to do something a little bit more, something that I just found much more interesting than just clickbait bullshit, is what I like to call it.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, you do have to come in under that remit to get it out there in the first place.
Yeah.
So I think it's nice the way you're kind of encasing those larger topics. Like, what was your first episode on?
It was on legalizing drugs to reduce
violence. That's not clickbait.
Yeah, yeah.
At its highest level. But when you get into it, you're all like, oh, it's like the TARDIS, you know? Bigger on the inside. As soon as you get into it, you're like, hey, let's have a look around here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Because I think that's one of the reasons why podcasts, like your podcast and a lot of other podcasts, are doing really well, is that people want more than the superficial tiny little bit of stuff where the expectation is built up, like, shocking, you'll never believe something that Gordon just did, number four, will blow your mind.
Yeah.
And then you go in and it's nothing and you're really pissed off. And the problem is you can't measure that through analytics. You can't measure how pissed off someone is after reading your crap online, but they still get the hit on the website. So it's job done. Everyone's successful. Pat on the back, we make money. So I think people who like podcasts, I think, want to go a little bit deeper into hearing about topics and enjoy listening and exploring the different alternatives instead of just, as I said, the clickbait bullshit headlines.
But that's why Audible is getting so much traction nowadays. Yeah. And podcasts in general, like, there's more people listening in Ireland to podcasts than there ever were.
Yep.
As of 2016, it was 57 million regular podcast listeners in the US. Like, that's a ferocious amount of people to be listening, to have as an audience, a potential audience that you can just make a show in your jocks, and 57 million people could listen to it.
And that market is growing, whereas radio is declining. It's going the exact opposite.
Yeah. But I think it is the freedom in the age of fake news, and the age of, I think, lowest common denominator media. There's a lot of people out there who are going, like, I'm not that tick.
Yeah.
It's
this whole business model of the only thing that matters is the click. Yeah. Because once the click comes onto, like the station I work for, we had a screen up in the newsroom, which was just on Google Analytics real time, right? Yeah. And if that fell below 100 people on the website, you had to get an article out and you had to jump that back up. And the success was based on how many people were on the site. It wasn't how long people were reading the content, how much people were sharing it or engaging with it. But you see, that's how you make the money. So you can't, in a way, you can't blame them because
that's the model that's made. Yeah. But this is what's happening. And we'll talk about this again. Like, you will definitely join us on those Conspiracy Guys episodes in season six, right? But, and we'll talk about it more because this is maybe not the remit of this show. Perfect. But we will get off into it. Like, I think that, like, Google and YouTube, the way they're working with stuff and the rise of fake news, this kind of stuff is making people more aware of what they don't like, because a lot of the time they're not looking, and the reason they're not looking is because the last five times they looked, they only saw shit.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, I'm not looking there anymore. And it's the reason why people are not watching TV. That you know, millennials are, 85% of them say, of those surveyed, 85% say that they pay for some sort of streaming media service and only pirate. The 15% who don't say they only pirate when they can't find what they're wanting to watch on a legitimate paid streaming service.
Yeah. So that's interesting, you know?
Like, piracy made for made the business for independent media consumption.
Yeah.
So if you're like pirating a TV series, it's only because the stations that you have won't put that TV series on.
Yeah, yeah. And that'll be if I said in a kind of global environment where, why does America get it a month before we get it? Screw that. Like, I want it now. And as I said, like, I don't really torrent or pirate anymore.
Me because either,
like, I get what I want through, I pay for Spotify and I pay for Netflix.
I've been paying for iTunes Music since it was launched. I haven't downloaded a song, I think, of more than 5 years. Like,
But I've started renting movies off iTunes now, because if that has what I want, it's not,
I do it
Netflix.
On YouTube. It's like $2 a night.
I haven't done paid renting on YouTube yet because I haven't.
But everything is on Google, on Google Play. Everything is on it.
Yeah.
And it's $2 or whatever for all the old 70s and 80s movies. The movies we were talking about on this show, you can go onto YouTube, type it in, and pay $2 and you can watch it, like, HD. It's phenomenal. So why would you, you know? But so for your show, it's Project 10.
Yep.
You can get it on iTunes or anywhere that has...
iTunes, not Spotify, SoundCloud, Podbean, anywhere where your usual podcast apps, and project10podcast.com if you want to go check out the site.
And there's a website as well then?
Website where I kind of give links to everyone who's been interviewed and some of the references or the stuff that I draw the info from and all that stuff.
People love them references, man. Love them sources.
You got the highest click links, the old source to the 2012 reports on economic growth.
I have a whole website there. Sources myself at thoseconspiracyguys.com if anyone wants to go check. They have all that stuff too. So project10.com,
podcast.com,
project10podcast.com, or Project 10 anywhere on those podcasting apps. So for this show, Why Press Play, we are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, Reddit, and basically any social media that you can think of. We're probably on it just at Why Press Play. We have a Discord server, which for those of you who don't know is a video, soon to be video, audio and text chat service, like them old Yahoo chat rooms of old. So we have a Discord server link on our Twitter or on our Facebook page that you can join in, and all the cool kids are hanging out in there talking about stuff that you can't really talk about on surface social media. You know who you are. We also have a Patreon, so patreon.com/whypressplay, where if you want to donate $1, $2, $5, $10, whatever you have spare down the back of the couch, if you want to throw it over to us, and it helps keep the show going, and it helps make more content, like lovely Carmack coming over here taking all the concessions from the from the concessions cupboard. I have to keep those biscuits all stocked up over here and the lights on. So go to patreon.com/whypressplay. You'll get like secret behind the scenes vlogs. We have extra videos and stuff that nobody gets to see. It's only for Patreon people. You get outtakes from a custom RSS feed that Patreon provides you, and you'll also be able to join in when we are playing on twitch.tv/whypressplay. So I do play PlayStation 4, Steam, and then the old consoles, Mega Drive and SNES games online. So you can join in and have the banter and chats if you're a Patreon subscriber, rather than just watching along. We also do movie watch-alongs using Rabbit, so rabb.it. for Patreon people as well, where the movies like this Super 8, we can go on Netflix and watch it all together, all join in one room, in one browser, and there's a comment section there, and we can even comment over the microphone and stuff as well. So you subscribe to White Press Play on any of your podcast players. We're on Stitcher, iTunes, Podcast Addict, Podbean. We're not on SoundCloud anymore, Lord of Mercy, because SoundCloud is having an awful trouble there now.
It's a weird one. It keeps pulling itself back from the brink miraculously, but yeah. I don't know what's going on with it.
A lot of people are bouncing because it was like a few dollars a month to pay to host your stuff.
I saw
and
that,
it was
yeah.
awful trouble trying to get it up there.
Really?
And yeah, so we're not on SoundCloud anymore. So sorry about the people listening on SoundCloud, but we are on everything else, and there are a bunch of awesome apps that you can get, like Leela, Overcast, Podcast Addict. Javier makes a great podcast app there, and some other new ones like Castbox as well is a great app if you're on iOS. So you can find us online anywhere, basically at YPressPlay on everything. So join in when we're doing some live shows or when we're playing some streaming games, because that's the best crack ever. So Super 8, 2011.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like, it doesn't seem like that long ago, but if you're talking about 2011, that's only like iPhone.
It's the second, third one, isn't
five.
It?
Yeah, the first one. The first five. Not 5S, but iPhone 5. Like, you're talking about, Obama hasn't even come into his second term.
Oh, shit.
Like, this is still like, yes, we can. This is like, oh, man, we're not poor and destitute anymore. Like, there's kids now starting to go to college again and starting to be like, money? What? Money?
Starting to have hope and belief in themselves before it all went horribly wrong in
again,
2016.
Yeah,
again.
It's 2020, I'm predicting a full economic crash. But 2011 was a time of hope. It was a time of post, what would you say, like post-financial destruction. Euphoria. It was like, oh, we're still alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's remember the times when things were kind of good, kind of. And a lot of this 80s stuff started to happen. Now, when I was in school between like 95 and 2001,
yeah,
it was very much 60s. It was a 60s vibe in the 90s. It was kind of like the baggy pants, you know, the X-Works jeans, all this kind of stuff.
Oh, I remember. I had a pair of them. Yeah,
of course,
yeah,
everybody
yeah.
did. And you had the Prodigy haircut, and you had like the long sleeve, or you'd have the Nirvana t-shirt. Or what I sported was a perpetual joint hanging out of my left hand with yellow fingers. And a black woolly jumper with my fingers poked through the cuffs. I wasn't the guy who wore the flannel shirt. I wore the black woolly jumper with my fingers poked through.
You would look great in a flannel shirt, man.
Yeah, well, if I can get one to reach over this heft. But the kind of time then was like a 60s revival. Then we went into the 2001 to 2010 era. And I think that was like a 70s revival where there was a lot of stuff like The Darkness came out, and they were all like glam rock was back, and there was a lot of the fashions kind of updated a little bit and turned into more glamour, more kind of Scissor Sisters and Sam Spade and all of these. It was kind of very... disco 70s, a lot of pop songs on the radio were a lot more disco-y. And then you're looking at the 2010s until the 2020, and it's kind of a reiteration now of the 80s.
It is definitely, it's definitely what I've noticed. A lot of people are, it's nostalgia. I don't know if it's always nostalgia center, but I've noticed the 80s is the main overarching theme of a lot of the most successful things. And it's obviously because we're hitting that age where we're looking back and kind of going,
this is our prime. So the people who make the media recreate their prime, possibly.
That's it, I imagine. So like in the 90s, the people who would have been, let's say,
our age then were
60s.
Yeah,
so I think
that could be it.
They like come along,
it's a 30-year
like,
repetitive wave, right?
It is kind of, we're like, what age is the majority of people at right now?
Yeah.
When were they young? Oh, the 70s. Let's go 70s. Let's go 80s. And probably, obviously, in 10 or 20 years' time, the young folk today are going to be like, do you remember the 2002s, man? Yeah, they were
the
amazing.
The Venga Boys. Remember singing that around
they were
the,
amazing, man.
Like getting hammered singing around, singing the Venga Boys at a fucking funeral, you know, with a
Shannon's singer in the corner.
The Venga Boss is coming. The Venga Boss is coming.
That would be beautiful.
Beep, beep. Like
and everyone goes, shh. Tony's doing the.
It's like a Kamalia, you know. I think there are definite recyclings of those 30-year thing, and it could be the teenagers are going, okay, what's cool? They're making it cool, and they're raiding their parents' wardrobes and pulling out all those styles.
And also, come on now.
Also, do you remember in like the late 90s coming up to Dublin for the... You're from Dublin, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So going into the town in the daytime and going into like Wild Child...
Don't remember Wild Child.
Wild Child was a secondhand shop where they basically broke open these containers that were all locked up with mothballs since the 70s and just released the 70s onto the 2001 children.
Yeah.
So we all came up in college and it was all fucking flares and big collared shirts with like mad patterns and stuff on
them. Yeah.
So it was just this recycling. I think J.J. Abrams really caught on to that very, very quickly.
Mm.
Went 2011. What's like... Basically, he's in his late 30s. He is the epitome of all the media that we have consumed all through our childhoods.
Yeah.
So he goes, I want to make an homage to the stuff that made me, that gave me the boner when I was like a little kid watching science fiction. Oh my God, this is fucking amazing. Like E.T., The Goonies, It, the original It, the mini TV series, Stand By Me
as
well. And then now there's kind of reiterations with the what are they called, the Dubber Brothers? No, the Stranger Things guys.
Oh, I don't know
the Doobie Brothers.
But
they're brothers anyway, and those guys are in the same boat where they were given a bunch of money by Netflix and went here, make a fucking nostalgia wank, and they really nailed it. Like got that late 70s, early 80s buzz, and I'm sure over the next 5 years or 4 years until the end of this decade.
Yeah.
We're going to be going into late 80s, which is like the mad coke come down, like the AIDS is going to come make a comeback. You know, we're going to see David Hasselhoff become huge again. Cocaine is going to be...
Did you say David Hasselhoff? Was there ever a Knight Rider movie?
I couldn't tell you.
Because that's an interesting one. Like, has that ever been made? One, was there ever a movie when he was doing it, the series? And has there ever been a remake of that series? Slash, has there been a remake of the...
I don't think there's been a remake of Knight Rider, but it's definitely something that's on the cards. Like, look what's happening in the media now. They're making remakes, reboots of everything. They redid Total Recall. Do you know what I mean? Like, did that need to be done?
No.
It really didn't.
And they've remade even the Spider-Mans, which haven't even been that old again. And it's kind of annoying.
Because it's a money-making franchise. So you need to, if you get to the end of the story, just go back to the start of it and start telling
time
it
travel.
But I retcon some shit, you know?
And I remember, it's interesting you say it about the reboots, because I remember reading something about the risk now with making a movie in Hollywood. Yeah. It's gone through the roof because of things like illegal streaming and downloading that. A lot less people are going to the cinema in one case.
A lot less people are going to the cinema, man, because there's a lot shitter movies there.
And it's mad because... Because
they're not making good movies, they're making reboots.
But what's happening is now is that they're unwilling to risk something new. So what they're doing is saying, even if we only have 40% of people... if only 40% of the fan base of Star Trek go to the reboot, we're still going to make far more money for certain than risking 100 or 200 million on a new idea. Do you know what I mean?
But at the same time, they made something like Wonder Woman, which had a female director, a female lead, in her first proper leading role.
Mm.
Huge gamble on a property that wasn't that popular back in the day. It was like, it was Wonder Woman. It was the same as like, the A-Team for dudes.
There
was no girls watching Wonder Woman going, oh, I love this, she's my hero, because little girls didn't watch Wonder Woman. It was more watched by like 12, 13-year-old boys who had funny feelings in their bellies and started like pulling their pudding. That was a gamble, and that broke all sorts of records.
Was it a gamble?
Yeah, I mean, look at.
But again, it was
Batman versus Superman.
But
the two new Superman movies,
shite.
All of them shite. Did okay in the box office, but all of them reasonably shite. Like totally disregarded as comic book movies compared to the Marvel universe.
But there still
isn't.
And
then she came in, like the Aquaman movie is not, Jason Momoa is not doing that great. Like the Wonder Woman film was to set up the next like
series of DC of stuff that's coming in.
Absolutely. And it fucking smashed it because it was well written, it was well directed, and it was well executed.
But it still,
and it was a good movie.
But it still wasn't, let's say, it's still, Wonder Woman was still already a thing in the world. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
not it, it, For me, I think something like Aquaman would be a bigger risk because not a lot of people would know that he existed as a superhero kind of thing.
Yeah, it was more famous in America because they had the TV show or whatever.
Yeah, and now they'll have to... And that's why they've introduced him in all the other movies that ruined all the other movies. You know what I mean? To try and tease you into them.
Yeah.
But there hasn't been, let's say, a superhero... Nobody has invented really a new superhero.
No.
Out of nowhere.
No.
Like the Batman Superman is still riding off the fact that it's a Batman Superman franchise or, you know, individually as well as together. So just seeing a lot of things where the reason they're rebooting these things is because even though they mightn't be groundbreaking, they're still, in a way, quote unquote, guaranteed a lot more income than, let's say, if we come up with Gordo Man. You know, if you're pitching in for the first time ever, they're going to go, no, we're going to do Spider-Man again. We're just going to do it for the 27th time.
I can see that. Like it is kind of with J.J. Abrams as well, when we're talking about reboots and sequels and stuff like that. Like J.J. Abrams has the Midas touch for that shit.
Yeah.
And they've given him both of the stars, both Trek and Wars.
I know, that's ridiculous.
That is like a fucking fat nerd's dream. Like he was a little fat nerd watching all that stuff. Getting his fucking media horn and going, yeah, I love it. And now he gets to control the fate of these like 50-year-old multi-billion-dollar franchises
with his
directorial experience. Like from Lost, from the first two episodes of Lost, when I saw it in like whatever 2005, I was like, this is amazing. And he had his hand well in for the first three seasons. And I was like, this is fucking class. Kind of dropped off a little bit after he wasn't so involved. And then you're watching stuff like Cloverfield going, God, fuck, this guy. And then he gets to direct all the Star Treks. He's on with Star Wars. The Star Wars Episode 9 kind of got fucked a little bit and the director got kicked out and all that stuff. Who did they go to? JJ.
Mm.
To have him on fucking speed dial on number one.
Got the
one
guy green button.
Like, he's going to smash it. He's going to smash it. Of course he is. Because he's gifted and he knows exactly what he wants and he's not afraid to take a gamble. And it's him... not being afraid to take the gamble, like the lads at Wonder Woman. Like, if you're not willing to make something new and people are crying out for something new.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, being original is the new being original. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's so many reboots and so many kind of sequels that are coming from this kind of stuff. They're even thinking about bringing back Alf. Do you know? Like,
As in...
Hey, how's it going? My name is Alf.
Alien life form.
Ah. Yeah.
I absolutely used to love that show.
Yeah, but can you imagine how shit that'd be if you brought it back? Like, remember when the Thundercats got re-released on DVD and everyone watched them and they all got their fucking weed out and they're all like, okay, man, let's relive our childhood. Oh, this is shit. This is really poor. Like, stories were really bad. Voice acting was really bad. Really bad, but the memories of it were fucking class.
Yeah.
But showing it back again, it didn't stand the test of time. Didn't hold up, man. So, the likes of E.T., the likes of the Goonies, like, did you watch them as kids? Did you love those movies?
Loved E.T. Yeah. And absolutely loved the Goonies. And they were two... very similar in style, but I think define the generation of, let's say, my age group anyway. Everyone has, I don't even know what year E.T. was out in. It's like, was it 80s or?
I think 80, it was 79.
79, like that's, absolutely love that movie, one of my favorite movies. A lot of interesting stuff about that, the remastering release that Spielberg did of that movie. Yeah. They took out a lot of stuff and then said, I shouldn't have done that, and took out all the stuff out.
He was just hanging out with George Lucas too long.
Yeah. There was a bit in there where I wrote that there was a, you know, when they go cycling off near the end of the movie and they go and they fly off, they're being chased by the local police. In the original movie, they all had shotguns. And in the re-release, the DVD re-release, they CGI'd all them out and put in walkie-talkies. And mad shit like that, where they took out all those kind of potential
trigger warnings.
You know what I mean? And then after a few years later, he came out and said, really shouldn't have done that, because the hardcore E.T. fans were like, what are you bastardizing this classic gem?
But a lot of people are seeing this stuff for the first time now, Cormac. Like, that's what this show was about, is kind of bringing that first time vibe to people. Like, if you haven't seen E.T.
Oh.
And there's a lot of people that haven't. Think about it, man.
Yeah.
They're looking at that going, that's from the fucking... That's from 30 years ago. I'm not bothered. Like, I'm talking about the normal people. There's fucking movie nerds and there's, like, science fiction geeks and kids who like that stuff who will go back and watch it. But most people who listen to podcasts, who walk around, have a job, you know, eat food, do poops. Like, most people who are 20... wouldn't be bothered their whole watching E.T.
And I know, because the risk now is, you know, we're like 20, 30 years on, you're looking at CGI and graphics and you're kind of like, E.T.'s got to be shit. But back in the day of filming those movies, you had to resort to using more props
that
kind of in a way, sometimes can appear more real.
Like in RoboCop or something like that. They had the actual robots and it was like plasticine. And then the guy's head wasn't totally CGI'd. It was actually fabricated.
And then if you compare, that for me gives a more realistic kick to something like the second Matrix that has a million Agent Smiths and a twirling. It nearly looked cartoon-like. Yeah. There was too much CGI. So,
and that doesn't hold up.
Not at all, because, you know, I remember...
Like, I can imagine in 20 years' time, people going back and watching the Transformers going, what fucking shit is this?
But that's happened to me with Independence Day. Yeah. I look back on Independence Day, one of my favourite movies of all time, and I went back and looked at it, the CGI, and I'm like, oh no, this is shit.
The green lasers are all like, this is muck.
But even when the cities were exploding, and you can look at the actors going...
But I remember watching the making of Independence Day, and when that thing is exploding, they actually had cars on hydraulics, so it is semi-physical, and then there's the flame is obviously...
But E.T. is amazing, because the only real special effect they need is the little E.T. dude.
The dude, yeah.
And there's
and that was all done by Jim Henson's Monsterworks or whatever it's called, the Sesame Street crowd.
Yeah, and I think Super 8 latches onto that, because one of the great things about that movie is it relies heavily on the story and it relies heavily on the acting and the vibe and the genre.
I think that.
It doesn't.
It's not special effects heavy like some of the reiterations of some of those movies. Like Goonies was not about special effects at all. It was about heart. It was about story. It was about character. It was about the relationship between the kids.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I think Super 8 has.
And it's our time down here.
And like, I love that movie as well. Again,
I'm taking this one back.
They had the real, not I don't want to say monster guy, but the kind of main scary dude in it isn't a CGI robot who's coming out of nowhere. It's real. And that's what I think it's good about. I really like that about Super 8 is that I think you can get invested in the movie a little bit better because you're sitting there and it's a normal everyday happening. You're a kid, you're brought back, all the nostalgia feels are hitting you, and it's not sci-fi fantasy. Not that it makes you believe that this could happen in your own little small town where you grew up, but because it isn't overly saturated, and because you don't actually see the main what would you call it, alien?
I'd call it creature.
You don't
want to say monster because that has negative connotations.
Yeah, so I don't want to trigger any monsters that might be listening.
Also,
or
spoiler
creatures.
Alert from now on.
That's what I was worried about.
I have to try it. Spoiler alerts now from now till. Like, you see it pretty quick in the movie, but we don't want to do any...
You see it pretty quick, but it's not overly used either, because for a while you don't actually get to see it full on. You get an elbow here and there, and a leg and a
foot
knee.
And an ankle.
And a shadow the odd time, and a scary reaction. So
or an arm that just comes out of a bush and pulls a lad's head off.
Yeah, so that's, I think, one of the reasons why it's really good, and kind of related to that E.T. Goonies vibe, is that it's not a two-hour... CGI fest where people are going, let's put 80 million into the CGI department and see what
like,
we can come
it's
up
not
with.
Like Starship Troopers.
Yeah, it's not.
It's
ridiculous.
More like
it's just the Goonies
Cloverfield or something.
And it's a little realer and that style of
or Signs.
Yeah,
watch Signs.
Is it Mel Gibson in Signs?
Mel Gibson
in the gas
and Joaquin Phoenix, and you don't get to see the alien at all. It's just like, oh look, the corn is moving, you know. But it's the suspense. There is a lot of suspense in this one. So, like, what we like to do on White Press Play is do a 60 seconds plot. Hopefully, no spoilers. But it's kind of hard. To describe the plot with no spoilers. So we're going to go with Cormac 60 seconds, no spoilers. Are you ready to give us the plot of the movie?
Am I ready to give you the plot of the movie? Yeah, go on.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Are you ready? Steady. Go.
Okay, it's really a story about bad parenting, about all the kids whose parents engage in emotional and physical abuse of them, don't support their dreams, and really hate what they're doing as young people and want them to conform to the patriarchal society that they've grown up in.
15 seconds.
Okay, so that's basically the overarching thing. Basically, kids are making a Super 8 film, which is a type of camera, while they're shooting one of the scenes. Some guy has a mental breakdown and crashes into a train that's passing by. They capture the whole thing. Something is released into the wild. The whole city is released into the wild that shouldn't have been released. The army comes, shit hits the fan big time, and then the remainder of the movie is trying to unshit the shit that's been shitted out in the town. And I imagine that nobody has ever spoken about what happened in that town since. It seems to be one of those things where they've tried to sweep it under the rug and go, we'll never talk about that time the thing came out of the train. No, I'm with you, boy. And I hope that's the plot.
This is 59 seconds. Hold on. It's it's hard to go through it all. We had my brother tried to do one, very difficult. Steve Ellie tried to do one.
Yeah,
Anthony Downs had a go.
And it's mad.
It's
because
tough to say it all. A lot of times people get caught in the first like 5 minutes, like, okay, we open on a
panning shot from a helicopter.
Yeah, this is it.
And then, you know, even just saying that out now, there's
but that was really good because there was no spoilers really either.
But there's I left out a ton, which I'm like, I should have said about, you know, there's the love interest.
Yeah, but that's hard to, like, that's a whole other 60 seconds to describe what that is, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And you know,
and you can't, I mean, it's very hard to talk about love interest when the girl is 12.
It's very true, actually. Think,
without saying anything inappropriate,
you'll be arrested. Mm. Which, actually, in reference to the new, have you seen the new It movie?
No, there's an orgy scene at the end, is there?
It's just weird. I think if you've seen it,
I thought there was from the book. There's an orgy scene at the end.
There wasn't an orgy scene in this one.
Okay, okay.
But in that's because it's only the first half of the book, I think.
Right.
For the movie, but people will know when I say love interest, it just seems a bit out of place. But anyway, Super 8.
I haven't seen it yet, but I plan
do go
to,
see it. Yeah, no, yeah. It's definitely worth a watch. And that, yeah, so Super 8. That's the kind of plot.
Right. So it's basically like five kids.
Yeah.
Goonies style.
Very much so.
Best buds from like a Midwestern like steel mining town that has a couple of stores and a couple of little, you know.
I think it's Ohio it's meant to be based in.
Somewhere in Ohio, yeah. Right? So you're talking about Midwest, everyone's mm-hmm. cool, very kind of quite white.
Very white.
Kind of waspy, maybe a bit Christian.
Traditional.
Traditional, mm-hmm. home, down home. And we see these five kids and yeah. One of them, Charlie, who is played by Riley Griffiths. He's an aspiring filmmaker and he has a little Super 8 camera that you used to get, you know, in the camera store, and you get your Kodak film, and he was making little zombie movies, little kind of project movies at home, and him and his mates all had a little production company, and Joe Lamb, the lead, I think he's basically the lead in the movie, Joel Courtney plays Lamb. And he does the makeup and special effects, and then there's his other mates, and they all have like certain jobs. One does the sound, and one does the explosions or whatever. And they go to a train station to film another scene for this zombie movie that they have to enter. So already you have like a pretty compelling. Motivation for the characters. It's not just like five kids and they're all like lollipop, lollipop, just skipping around town. There's something, they're doing something.
There's an original intention laid out from the start.
Absolutely.
And it's to enter the film competition in the school, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you're already reminded of that, you know, that
the stakes are there.
The state, but that desire and need to be accepted by your peers as a young person who hasn't got a clue what the world is going on. So there's that desperation, and they are.
I played the guitar. I was like, I want to be in a band. I want to be cool. I want to play a gig and
talk
have
to
people
girls.
Look at me. Yeah, I want something in between their fanny and my penis that we can talk about.
Something to hide the awkwardness that is there as a hormonal teenage boy. So that's definitely it. So there's that kind of, and they're kind of outsidery kids as well.
Yeah,
you know I mean, they're not the cool kids. They're not playing football or sports.
They're doing cool stuff. I feel they're the AV club.
There you go. They're the AV club, and they're doing that kind of stuff.
They're not sporty, and we can see this from a scene where Joe and his dad, who you really love, Kyle Chandler, right?
Yeah.
His dad, Kyle, Jackson is the Jack, like is the name of the character. So Kyle Chandler is his dad, and they're sitting in the. They're basically like the da is left on his own after his ma's killed in a steel. Is it a steel mill? What would you call a steel mill? You know, it's like a wood mill. Is it a steel mill? A
refinery?
Steel refinery. Okay. So it's a factory, and the whole town is kind of built around this factory. So Joe's mom, Jackson's wife, dies in this accident, you know. And we open on like him sitting forlornly on the swing, and he's all like, oh, you know, me ma. And 4 months later, then we cut to the lads all sitting on the back of a car, and they're all like singing My Sharona and stuff like that. And it's quite like, yeah, they're mates, and they're fucking shut up. What did he call them? Chompers, shut up, Chompers. He has massive teeth or whatever, and it's like swearing at each other and being like real teenagers, kind of like in the Goonies, where it's real people, not like in anything from Disney like iCarly, where it's all like weird vacuous kind of empty people.
It's really odd
people.
I think I found it really funny as well when you're seeing them slagging each other, you know what I mean? It takes you back to that kind of because you can see the roles defined very much so, like director man with the camera, what's his name again?
Charlie.
Sorry. Charlie. He seems like, you know, the bossy asshole kind of guy who's just pushing through stuff.
But also, he is a little bit insecure. We find out later on how insecure he is. But there's one scene where they're all sitting in the cafe and he orders fries, and then Chompers is eating his fries. And he's like, hey, lay off the fries. And he's like, you know, it's not like you need him, you fat cunt. Like, it's. And I can identify him. Like, we used to talk like that, and I didn't take it to heart. I was all like, yeah, well, you're a fucking, you smell like you're
mad. Yeah. And it's just,
I rode your ma. Like, it's all.
Yeah,
kind of no holds barred talk, and it's natural. It's natural teenagers in a natural environment. So they're making this movie.
Yeah,
Charlie has written this extra scene, and he wants like production value. So they go to the little train station value, in the middle of Ohio, and they're filming this thing. And the train starts coming along. Lo and behold, like a train appears out of nowhere, and it turns out to be an Air Force train. And as they're filming it, Joe, he looks behind him and he sees that there's a car on the tracks. The car smashes into the front of the train spills over, and all these little white blocks fly all over the place, and something comes out of the train, and we find out later what that is. But the guys are basically in this Armageddon type situation, running around the field going like, ah, we're gonna die. And all through this, we see how there is a kind of a future love connection bonded between Joe and Alice, who's played by Elle Fanning. Sister of Dakota Fanning.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't think she'd be famous only for her. isn't it her sister?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Do they not look identical? No. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're sisters.
That's amazing.
Only a couple of years apart. So Elle is basically like a 12-year-old. She comes from kind of a broken home. And we find out later on why the home is broken. Mm-hmm. But she basically turns up in her dad's car.
Yeah.
Because Charlie had arranged to have her drop them off at the train station, and she's an aspiring actress, and we're going to get her to act in the movie, and she turns a brilliant performance, brings all the boys to tears, and
that's probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie, where it's just a run through. They're doing a run through of the scene, and she's reading the lines to the, you know, to the guy at the time who's, you know, that in their little movie within the movie.
Martin is the character's
and name. Everyone else on the sound and behind the camera, it's just like, once they're done, she's
mouths
like,
open, you're like, what the fuck?
Was that okay? And like, I suppose I was fine.
It's coughing and wiping her eyes and all. But it was a powerful performance.
It was really good.
And basically, when Joe is doing her makeup beforehand, he's kind of touching her face. And as you know, if you're a 12-year-old and you get to touch any part of a woman, you're kind of like, oh, I'm sexually bonded to you now for life. Like, it's very, you know, an intimate situation. And they start talking, and they're hanging out afterwards. And bonded through this trauma of the you know, the train crash and all this stuff. You see how the characters are so clearly defined. And this is I think makes the movie for me, is that J.J. Abrams, when he puts a character archetype on somebody, they stay like that. Their decisions are informed by that character archetype.
Yeah.
Their eventual comeuppance or redemption is based on that character archetype. And there's no like swip swaps, or there's no like, oh man, there's no feeling of like, oh, he should have fucking got worse than that. Like, he didn't deserve, or he deserved to die or whatever. J.J. doesn't leave you hanging.
Yeah.
And you see that in Lost.
Yeah.
Like, the people who deserve to die in the first season fucking died. You know what I mean?
I mean, speaking of deaths, how none of them died from that horrific train crash is a miracle.
It was amazingly shot.
And
really well put together. CGI-wise, the train is entirely CGI.
Oh, is it?
But the thing that they were running through, and the flames and the flame explosions, are all real.
Yeah.
So they were running through basically a big field of smashed up cars.
Explosions. Yeah.
And it looked really, really realistic. Like, the train, 2011, it kind of looks a bit cat.
Yeah.
When you're looking at it now, I was watching it today and it looked a little bit like, it's a bit computery.
Yeah, you can see a lot. You can see the computer strings on the way pulling it along.
I don't think JJ is going to, he's going to go back and redo it. Steven Spielberg or anything.
When I watched it recently, I didn't notice an end like that. I was convinced. Now, I know a lot of the CGI is hidden in places where you wouldn't even believe.
This is it. But CGI, it's mixed in with real stuff, so you don't really notice it.
Yeah, your brain is tricked. Because that was probably one of the, obviously, it was not the main scene in the movie, but that sets the whole other story in play, because it's not now about the movie competition. It's about, holy shit,
what the fuck just happened?
And now we're going in a new direction, because, as you said, they're throwing it through the end of the world scenario.
But it ends up being like the stakes are set and then reason even more. So like for an example that like from an 80s movie, and the way 80s movies were set up, which I think is what makes this stand out in a movie that's made in 2011.
Yeah.
For the likes of Back to the Future.
Yeah.
So Back to the Future, where he had to go back to the past and then to the future again.
Mm.
The reason he was going back to the past is because he had to get his... he had to save Doc Brown's life by going back in time to make sure that the Libyans wouldn't shoot him. But he went back too far, had an accident, and then caused his man Dan not to kiss, which meant that he'd never exist. And if anyone ever told him, if you just let that happen and you didn't exist, then Doc Brown would still be alive.
Yeah.
But it was his own savior. So not only was he saving Doc Brown, selfless, he then ended up having to save himself, but also his brother and his sister and his man Dad's relationship, which ended up making them way better. And all of the stuff that happened through the whole movie at the end ended up like resolving massively positively for everybody involved.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a real big payoff.
Yeah, yeah.
And J.J. Abrams kind of captured that 80s movie like mechanic, I guess you'd call
it. Yeah,
you
call it, but by like pressing on the, like, as I said, exactly upping the stakes. So it's not just this, it's everything else that goes around with it. And everything else is relying, or he uses that to resolve or intensify the relationship with the dads. The friendships, the
relationships ended up getting bonded as it went along, and they were always developing. But the best thing I like about Riley Griffiths, and we'll go into like best supporting cast is what we like to do here on White Press Play, is pick somebody who was especially fantastic in the movie. And one of my particular fantasticisms was Riley Griffiths, who played the fat kid Charlie, who makes the movies. He said such lines as, "I haven't leaned out yet. The doctor said I'm going to."
That's an amazing line. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Were you ever fat, Cormac?
Was I ever fat? Recently, yeah.
But when you were small.
I was born fat as a fat kid. Grew out of it.
Yeah.
Got fat again in college a few years ago. Trying to grow out of that now. But
I wouldn't put you... I put you down as lean. You're like a fighter's body.
A sloppy fighter's body.
Sloppy fighter. Like I used to be a fighter. But I mean, were you ever like...
I was never fat, let's say, in school or growing up
never
as a teenager.
In your teenagers. No. Okay, because it's a different type of fat, you know.
Yeah,
you grow into it, but it makes your character. And this kid had... absolutely got to have a fat kid's personality.
You know, that movie wouldn't be allowed to be made today because it would trigger too many fat people or with their kids. You know, it'd be too offensive to too many people.
Put the cake down and cop onto yourself. Do you know what I mean? I'm fat. I know what it's like, but I know what I'm doing. I'm not going out and going, "Hey, fat, but you can be healthy at any size." It's like, no.
No, you can't. Science says no. But
sorry.
He was brilliant in this movie.
Brilliant.
And obviously he was one of the drivers of the initial movie story. So a lot of the initial story, it was his fault they were at, not fault, but he was the reason they were at the train station.
Exactly.
And as I said,
and the linchpin of the movie, I think, is Charlie, is Riley Griffith's character, because nothing would have happened unless it was that, and all of the great reveals all happen because of his character. All of the great relationship connections all happen because of his character. And at the end, he does the ultimate sacrifice. He's like, "Leave me behind, go complete." Like, "I'm going to play second fiddle to you, Joe."
Joe
gets to do the thing. He is Mouth from the Goonies. He is River Phoenix's character in Stand By Me to Gordy LaChance. He's you go on and take the glory and I'll just be here in the wings.
I'll sacrifice. He's Jesus.
That character, you know. So like fat kid though, he's low self-esteem. So when Joe and Alice start falling in love, he can see that and he gets whingy with Joe and he's like, "You know that I loved her. Why, you know, I asked her to be in the fucking film and now she's all talking to you and all." And Joe is like, "What, man? She's only talking to me." He's like, "Yeah, but you haven't sexually developed yet, and I have. And I want her to touch my ding dong."
That's such another
and insecure and jealous and all of these.
But that's another great bit about that movie that you'd only get from a child acting cast or that story around young people, because you can all relate to it.
Yeah.
Where you're a child growing up, and the girl that you like actually likes your best mate, and you're horribly stuck there, but you haven't said anything, so you're just kind of like, I can't complain because no one knew that I liked her, never said anything.
Yeah.
But you're meant to be my mate now, you're pissing me off.
And I can't tell you now because you're going to be... And then you have to live with it all through your teenage years, so you lose all the fat, you get real muscly, so you can like fight somebody.
And then you're going to grow up and he's going to marry the wrong person. And he's going to live... that's going to be the core trauma that he's going to, you know, need years of therapy to try
and
resolve.
That's the thing, man. You can lose the fat in your body,
you can't
but you can't lose the fat in your
fat.
Mind. If you're a fat kid on the inside, you'll be a fat kid on the outside, man.
Yeah, but so, it is funny how that as you position him in that story, but that scene is fantastic.
Oh, absolutely.
And you don't get that in sci-fi movies, or you wouldn't get that in Iron Man or Thor or anything.
It's one of the subtler emotions can't. It's a subtle emotion that you can't really build a plot point around.
Yeah.
Unless the whole movie is about that. So you get the rom-coms that have that jealousy, that triangle, but that's all the movie is about. It's like the Bechdel test, you know, these kind of nomenclatures on these types of movies. So you can't have a jealousy narrative inside an action movie because there's not enough room or space to build up the tension and build up all the stuff.
When you have the childhood innocence.
Exactly.
There, and you know, it's people are still trying to figure it out.
It's a raw wound. Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter that it's just because, you know, as kids, people like each other, and then it's just like,
But at the same time, it tells in his character. And this is where J.J. Abrams writing, like, I could see in those little kids all of the, maybe the inner slices of J.J. Abrams as a kid.
Right.
You know, there's the kid who loves the fireworks and the kid who's afraid to do stuff. And then, like, the normal kid who, like, doesn't notice that people are falling in love with him or that he's a hero. And he's like, I don't know. And then there's, the fat, selfish, self-obsessed, whingy, jealous fat kid.
Yeah.
Who's like, I liked her first, boo. Or when after the train crash, right?
Mm.
He's Charlie's the kid who goes, let's go to the train station. Oh, the train's coming, production value. Like when the train crashes, they're going, we have to save ourselves. And we talk about what happens when the train crashes. But the character of Charlie the next morning, so Joe ends up always going to Charlie's house, the Kaznik family house. Right, so they go to the Kaznik's and they're all around, and he has like a sexy sister and a not sexy sister, which seems to be, you know, the 80s movie trope as well. You have or in Modern Family you have a sexy sister and a not sexy sister. You don't have any sisters, Conor, do you?
I have two,
and there's one sexy and one not sexy.
Pass.
Okay. And I don't have any, so it's not weird for me to ask that at all. So if normally the empathy that should be in somebody watching something like that on TV, they're watching the news report of the train crash and it's all like that.
Yeah.
And Joe was like, oh my God. And the man goes, did you hear about the train crash? And he's like, no, I didn't hear. And they go over and watch TV, and Charlie's looking at the telly, salivating, going, oh my God. And Joe's like, what's up? He's like, production value. I was like, what? He's like, let's go back to the scene of the accident. To fucking like film more stuff to make this movie amazing. So he is a one-track mind. He's selfish. He's self-obsessed. He takes
initiative as well. Opportunistic, you could say.
Could he be the true leader of this group? Why is Joe the lead? He's the lead because he gets the man? Or because he gets the girl? Like, what's the... Is Charlie not the leader of the group? And there's like a power struggle there. That's a really nice dynamic in the film to be.
Yeah,
to
I definitely think he is. And I think, as mentioned already, he's the driving force behind the whole plot and moves everything forward. And he said, an opportunistic man who will grow up to probably get his way in everything he wants in life. Well, maybe not for a few years because he's fat, and we know how the Americans treat little fat kids. But.
Yeah, but he goes, I'm going to grow into my lean. Like, he knows he knows that he has a few growth spurts coming.
He's got a plan. He's very well organized. Like, when I hit 16, we're good. But for now,
he's going to play football. I just like get good at wanking or whatever until 16. But it's just such a nice character, and you know, he works hard, and the meaning and message behind his character is like forthright. But at the same time, then he has jealousy issues, and he has all these other types of issues, and he's a little insecure, but he is brave. He does want to go ahead and do the stuff. He wants to go back to the scene of the crime later on when they're talking about going to get the evidence from Dr. Woodward, who we'll talk about in a sec. Like, when you go back to get the evidence, he's breaking into the school and running around and doing all the stuff that the rest of them are doing, like pushing them on. I think brilliant character, absolutely best supporting for me anyway, definitely. So when you're talking about the crash that released the alien, the monster
thing.
I don't want to talk about too many scenes in it because it'll kind of ruin the movie, talking about particular bits or even at the end.
Yeah.
But the bit where Mr. Woodward, who is the kid's science teacher, they find him bleeding in the car after the crash, and they come over and he wakes up and he's like, don't let them find you, get out of here. And the kids are all like, are you sure? And then he pulls out a big fucking gun and they're all like, okay, fuck it, I'm out. And they bounce, you know, and you think he's brown bread. And later on you see him then, like, you know, tied to a table, and they're interrogating him and stuff like that. It's a small part, but it's a lovely true a line in the narrative, because you get to see films of him, and you get to see, like, he is a massive part of this alien's life.
And he's obviously the reason why the plot twists at the end again a little bit, like, there's that there. But and in a weird way, the obviously he could have somehow at the start of this movie revealed what he knew.
Absolutely.
And then the story's over. Do you know what I mean? But he's really, really,
as is the way,
he's really well threaded through the rest of the movie, and he's obviously part of the solution to the problem they're faced with, and they have to kind of go stage by stage to try to find out what he knows.
He seems to be like the guy who dies first in an Agatha Christie movie or in a, like a Poirot movie. It's all like you find out the means and method of the murderer, but not the murderer's identity. The murderer was, and he just dies just before you tell. But it's like, okay,
he's kind of like that. Yeah,
he's
a
poisoner, and it is a kind of a tropey character.
And he's one of, I think, the character who obviously builds a lot of curiosity straight into the story.
Yes.
So not only like, do you what have, is,
we don't even know that it's an alien at this point.
This is it,
or what it is. Even if it, like, I didn't even know if it was.
And I think
an alien.
That, I think that was really good, because they could have, it could have went into a straight a reveal straight up where it was like, we have to defeat this alien. But the fact,
like, attack the block, which is like the first 10 minutes you're like, I know the crack,
and there you go, and you're like, that's grand, we're going to do this, and we're going to figure out how they can come up with some way to do it. But the fact that that is held back, and you're,
puts it into thriller mystery country rather than just action.
But as a viewer, I think you're sitting there, and that curiosity is stepped up a notch because it's held back, and that reveal is held back. I remember watching it and being more curious, because one, you're confused in a way, because the fact that he drove his car into the thing and he's alive, and then he wants him to get rid of him. First of all, you're like, what does he know? Why did he do that? Why did he blow up that train and crash into the train? Was he just crazy? And
you then, don't know his motives. You don't know the motives of the monster, which is revealed only minutes later when Charlie and Joe are reviewing the footage from the Super 8 camera. It fell over when the train crashed, and it filmed everything, including the monster getting out of one of the train cars. Army are chasing him. You know some shit's happening. If you've ever watched an episode of The X-Files, some shit's going down, man. But Woodward's motivations and intention are absolutely not revealed. And I think, like, we might try and not do it now, because that is the crux of the film, I think.
It is. And I said, it's his knowledge of what's happening is drip fed through the rest of the story. And it's not like a computer game, but you have to go step by step, and they have to find out. It's like level one, they find out.
Well, they're fucking kids, though, and it reveals them, kids. Because they're not looking for answers. They're just reacting rather than being proactive. They're reacting to stuff that's happening. Some of the shit that I saw, which was like, the underhanded dealings of the Air Force when they set fire to the field and push all the people out of this, out of the town, so they can have a clear run of trying to inspect the place to try and find out where the monster is or whatever. The way that the Air Force lads were involved in kind of nefarious stuff and experiments, and you know it's dodge, like, you know, I don't want to say what the white boxes are or what the monster is, but, like, you know it's sketchy. And the fact that the dad, Jackson, played by Kyle Chandler, still made, and in true J.J. Abrams fashion, takes his archetype and fucking hammers it in. Never stops being the you know, stalwart sheriff, like, small town sheriff,
always investigating,
always like Fargo, like, always sniffing, always be like, hey, that's
just not letting it be, not letting things go. You know what I mean?
Damn it. Like Twin Peaks, like some shit. He's always picking. So Kyle Chandler was a whopper character in this, and it seemed he was a lot darker than he needed to be.
Think so?
I think so. But it gave an extra nice slice of realism, because his wife had just died 4 months beforehand. He's like talking about this mad shit, and it seems like, Jackson, stop being so crazy, go
take
have
some
a holiday
time off.
Go have a holiday for yourself. Like the deputy sheriff is telling him, like, listen, I know you're going mental, this is the reason you're going mental, because your wife just got squashed by a big piece of steel.
And I think that you can see that really well, that you can see his internal struggle with himself trying to sort his life out, and the external struggle with the world he's in. He's kind of like, obviously fighting again, not fighting, but coming up with resistance against everyone around him in a way, and they're all telling him one thing, and he's like,
but even come finding resistance in his son's happiness, because his son and Alice are kind of like falling in love by total chance, and only for Charlie they wouldn't have been introduced. But it just so happens to happen that Alice's dad, and I don't mind a spoiler, it is a nice thing to find out in the movie, but like to talk about it now to show how good the movie is, like, this is a total other plot point, far away, like a plot line far away from like the aliens and the
people in the next
getting,
town over that
it,
plot
it
point
it really
yeah,
is
yeah.
Like, so Alice's dad Lewis.
Yeah.
You see in the opening scenes of the movie, he comes to the funeral and Jackson gets real tick and he puts him in handcuffs and fucks him in the back of the car and all. And there's an immediate animosity between these two people and you don't really find out what's going on or why. Joe is over trying to get Alice to join
in the second
day of filming after the crash. And she's like, get the fuck out of here. And he comes up the porch going, who the fuck are you? I know you. You get out of here. Your father's a cop. You fucking get out of here, right? And there's that real animosity between those two guys. And you don't find out for ages and ages. But that animosity is built. Jackson is telling Joe, you're not hanging around with her. Don't be hanging around with her. Lewis is telling Alice, don't be fucking hanging around with him. And it's like star-crossed lovers who are forbidden from families.
West Side Story and Romeo and Juliet. And it's funny you mention that because they could have, Abrams could have left that, I think, in a way, because he's the deadbeat drunken dad.
Yeah.
And he could have, like, for me in my head, it was the animosity there is just because you have the law and you have drunk, not criminal, but drunk fucking fuckhead, for want of a better word. And that's why, as I said, that story is developed nicely. He didn't have to develop that either. He could have left it as, this guy's just a drunk idiot who gets
one level.
One level apart. And then you're like, oh shit. He's
the town ne'er-do-well.
There you go. And that still would have made sense and been fine. But the fact that that's, as I said, dropped in as well adds again to not the realness of it, but you get a hell of a lot more out of the story than other sci-fi slash thrillers that are just about overcoming the evil alien sort of thing.
The outward enemy. But exactly. this is the inward enemy.
And this is the enemy.
And it does have a lovely, nice, circular resolution as well. There is a nice resolution to it. Yeah. I don't want to spoil it, but like,
but he's the alien.
It's a minor plot. Like Lewis Danner, playing by Ron Eldred, who's Shep in ER, for those of you know, he basically, like, he's a bad guy and he treats Alice very poorly and he's an alcoholic and he's kind of all this, and then you find out later on, as Alice and Joe are bonding together, start talking about, like, she's always like, and I thought this was a little bit kitsch. It was a little bit too kind of trite or tropey, because he's like, he's always like fingering this little silver locket, you know, on a chain in his pocket and all this stuff, you know. And she's like, oh, she spies it. And it's a bit too obvious. That bit is a little bit like, all right, fucking stop jamming it down my throat, JJ. And she eventually goes, like, what's that? And she's like, it's me, ma. Oh, yeah, you know, I'm really sorry about that. And he's like, what? Yeah, I'm really sorry about that. My dad was drinking that day. So we find out that Lewis Dennard was drinking. And he couldn't come to work that day.
Yeah.
And in order to fill in for him,
she had to.
Joe's ma had to go in and fill in. And there was an accident that day. And inadvertently, Lewis is kind of blamed for it. And then he drinks himself into a stupor then. And he's kind of blaming himself. And later on, when the two of them have to team up, when Jackson and Lewis have to team up as fathers helping their kids. And there's a lovely scene in the van where he's like, I'm really sorry what happened to your wife. And Jackson kind of has to come to terms with the fact that, like, it's not really his fault. And he has to forgive him no matter how bad he feels about it. He's like, ah, it's not your fault, man. Don't worry about it. And they kind of...
Have a Budweiser.
Yeah. It is like, America! We forgive people! Except communists, Nazis, North Koreans. Yeah. But it was like... You know, this real nice...
When you unpack the entire movie, there's a hell of a lot going on.
Loads.
Do you know what I mean? Because really, I said, that's the one thing that you get with that. I think that 80s style children coming of age with their friends adventure movie allows for more points and for those plot lines to develop. Whereas if it is just, let's all jump into our fighter jets and shoot some aliens down. It's not...
It's not Transformers.
And it's not as if...
Transformers is all action. Or it's not but it's Along
forced.
Came Polly.
It's forced.
Which is the other forced emotional
stuff. That's what
stuff.
I mean. Yeah, like it lends itself naturally to have those storylines that work really well and give it a much better substance. Like I said, something like Independence Day, it's a completely different movie. I know there is some other little plot points in Independence Day, but that style of movie, if it tried to do as much... with the relationships, with the backstories, with the added plots, it would just be like stupid.
I think, like, in the likes of Independence Day, Will Smith and the storyline with his family and his kid, very loosey goosey.
And that's just wrapped up with, okay, let's get married, now I'm going to space, happy days, great, that's fine. It's just thrown in for the love interest, you know what
but
I mean?
But the relationship between the David. Yeah. And his father, the Jewish guy, is like, oh my God, if I had known I was going to meet the president, I wouldn't want a tie. I look like a schlemiel. Like, that kind of stuff. Like, their relationship absolutely blossomed on the drive in, and David is doing this stuff. And he's like, oh, David, I finally get to see you work. I'm amazed. I didn't know you'd do this. And then, what's his name? Jeff Goldblum is all dad, this is... difficult. It's just like they're really bonding, whereas I didn't believe the Will Smith kind of thing. I always felt that he was kind of on his own. But yeah. In this, I think every little relationship that's made is satisfied and has a resolution. Yeah. Every little
seed that's planted just kind of...
It grows. It's allowed to grow as well, and there is room for that. There's a load of awesome action as well, though, when towards the end, they're destroying the town with missiles and it's all...
And it's really good because I think it's...
Spoilers coming now, by the way. It's, so fast forward maybe, I think, maybe 5 or 6 minutes if you don't want to get these massive spoilers.
I think what's good about these type of movies is that it builds to a crescendo, so it's not smashed into your face from the get-go. Yeah, do you know what I mean? In you're getting to understand the story, understand the town, you're getting the feel of the whole place.
Yeah.
And it's not just...
It's a little small town. It's a little podunk fucking drive-through, like, two streets
You wouldn't believe action at the start of the movie either. Do you know that kind of way? Like, you believe a train crash. That's no problem at all. And then it obviously escalates and escalates up.
But it's not like... it's not like with, like, Mars Attacks or something. Yeah, you know, where there's like... There is a definite force and you have to... You can see that gradually at one point, you know, Jackson looks up and there's like some Air Force personnel trucks just trundling into like three of them.
Yeah.
Just trundling into town.
Yeah.
And then later on he sees some dudes like standing outside the store with guns and they're just like keeping an eye out. And gradually over the space of the middle of the movie...
Yeah.
The military presence in the town increases and increases and increases.
And then they take over.
And it's called Operation Walking Distance, is the name of the operation the Air Force are taking part of. And because it's not working, slowly infiltrate, they have to set fire to the grass around the town and then the town gets evacuated and all. But it just, it's not like all of a sudden, the National Guard are on the fucking border of the town and they're fighting the 40-foot woman. It's like a creep, a natural creep. Mm. So it's not so...
It's sudden or jarring, you could say.
Yeah,
it's
Independence Day. Like, let's all shoot the green thing.
Yeah, yeah. And let's come together with the world. That's a good point. It does actually naturally.
A really nice thing with Woodward. Now, this is spoilers. A nice thing with Woodward, the fact that he has a massive history. Like, fast forward if you don't want to hear this, right? He has a great massive history, like, with the monster.
I know.
The monster has a psychic connection via touch.
Yep.
Woodward used to work for, like, the Area 51 crowd Nellis Air Force Base. He has all of these, like, mad, like, qualifications and all of this, like, contacts and stuff. Loads of evidence he keeps in a container out the back of the school and shit like that. And the lads break into it and they try to watch these little films of them making the spaceship with the little white blocks. Like, that's fucking class.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end, the last 20 minutes, just like bang, 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 bang. Resolution, resolution, resolution. So satisfying ending.
And the thing is that you do go with that as well. Because I remember looking at it like, as I said, it does come back and it makes sense. And I think you're always rooting for the kids when they find this out. It's as if you're nearly finding out at this time. You're like,
now I know.
And then, like, do we reveal?
There's not like with a lot of these kind of movies, there's not like these very obvious, here's a MacGuffin, here is an item that has no meaning now and is kind of feeling a bit out of place.
Mm.
But you know that somewhere, and you're waiting the whole movie going, what's he going to use that thing for? What's he going to use that thing for?
Yeah.
The MacGuffin was the little white box.
Yeah.
But at some point, I think before the halfway mark in the movie, there's like, it starts jiggling around at the table and it flies out through the wall.
Yeah.
And it's gone then.
Mm.
But it played its part. It played its MacGuffin-y part, which was part of the spaceship that this thing needed to fly away. And I think it's really nice that you can watch a film that you're not like waiting, looking for the thing or what's the magic, you know, the amulet that I wore around my neck the whole time, that was the key to the whole thing. And then
because I know there's that thing in script writing and screenwriting is that the solution to the overall problem has to be introduced in the first act of the movie. And you're like, okay, fair enough. Because
otherwise it's a deus ex machina and it doesn't feel like there's any kind
of... Yeah, there's completion to it. It's not like...
It's not a resolution. It's from nowhere answer.
Like, can you imagine in Super 8, if out of nowhere, someone in the last 10 minutes introduced some sort of kryptonite for the monster and was like, oh, why didn't we just use this? Oh, like, yeah, sorry, here's the antidote to the problem.
Like War of the Worlds. Like, it's like, all they have to do is breathe oxygen.
I hated that movie with a passion because of that new one where it was they ran out of money and it was just Morgan Freeman going, they all got a cold. That's the end. Please leave.
Yeah.
You're like, what?
Excuse me?
But
a lot of the times what they do is they get to the end and go, okay, that's how they die. How are we going to make that happen? And then they just jam it into the first act.
Yeah,
but this seems to be written purposefully, and it was written and directed by J.J. Abrams. So
he knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing. A nice quote, and one of the best quotes that I think from the film that makes absolutely no sense, wasn't introduced. It wasn't like an emotional anchor made, like from a, this is a thing his dying mother said, the last thing she said before she died or whatever. The alien has Joe, spoilers, the alien has Joe in his hands, makes the connection, sees that Joe's a good guy, and we get a really lovely close-up image of the monster, yeah. You know, and he pulls back like the secondary eyelids and you get to see into his eyes and they look quite human. It could be even an evolution of human, right? And Joe says, apropos of nothing, looks in the alien's eye and says, bad things happen, but you can still live. And then the alien goes, cool, boss. And he puts him down.
He's like, you know, you're right. Fair play to you.
But it makes no... Like, that is the only bit in the whole film that I went, what?
Didn't like it.
What the fuck? Made no sense.
Are you thinking, because I know that kind of bit, it's as if he's talking to his younger brother or something. Do you know what I mean? Where he's trying to go at a funeral, that he's holding him, kind of going, you got this, pal. I know you've struggled through life, but you're okay.
I think that was what he was going for.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I've learned with you. And maybe what it was that the monster was telling that to Joe through psychic powers and he wasn't good at English and Joe was just repeating it.
So Joe didn't even know what he was saying, but he was
maybe somebody
speaking to himself,
exactly,
maybe, via the alien.
Maybe somebody out there can inform us if you want to get onto us at Twitter at YPressPlay and tell us, did we totally miss moments in the movie?
Joe was saying that to himself because he's finally come to terms with his mother being...
Yeah, you can live. Maybe he was talking to his father, Kyle Chambers.
Dad was behind the monster. He's like, Dad, seriously.
Dad, this is a really elaborate lesson to get me over my mother's
just
death.
Just go to AA or something and just sort yourself out, please.
You really like Jackson as a character, did you?
Can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
It was just because he was in Early Edition.
Is it?
that I was just like, because Early Edition was one of the shows, I think it was one of those shows when I was a kid I used to watch on a Saturday morning kind of thing.
Loved it.
And absolutely loved it. And, you know, yeah. Fascinated by the fact
that... It was that Earthworm Jim.
Oh, Earthworm Jim.
And Bug Juice. I used to watch
Bug Juice.
Channel 4. It was on like the Channel 4, you know, when the English get a bank holiday, you call in sick to school.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
Call in sick to school. No, you pretend you were sick and wouldn't have to go to school.
Call in sick would be way handier. Yeah, yeah. Hey, Mrs. Jones, I can't
come in.
No, but I loved him just because it reminded, kind of added on top of the 80s vibe, was seeing him brought me even further back into a regressed childhood state. And I just loved the fact that the whole, if you haven't seen the TV series, Early Edition went on for,
I think, three or four seasons.
And it was basically, he got the paper, tomorrow's paper today, he got it ahead of time.
A black cat brought it to him
and he was able to go around and save lives and also bet on the horses and win the whole time and continually to win the lotto and stuff. So
I get his hole a lot.
Well, yeah, you know, which was the main part of Early Edition, you know, coming early. he for me was one of the reasons.
He's
was
a great comedic
just,
actor, I think.
Really?
And in this, there's a couple of little... Because he plays that dry, like, the guy that things happen to guy. This, there's a few moments when he's like, ah... You know, like, he's saying to the kid, like, hey, I left a couple of slices of pizza in the fridge for you. And one of the other policemen goes, oh, I ate them. And he just, Kyle is like... Like, it's a real... Oh, shit just happens to me vibe off him, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know if you'd call him... He was like, was he a supporting actor? Have I cheated with this one a little bit? Because
I think he was, yeah.
He wasn't obviously front and centre because the kids are front and centre.
Yeah, but he was part of that big, like, dad's...
Dad's
kind of storyline.
The deadest story.
I think that motivated... Like, their relationship also motivated the illicit nature of Alice and Joe's relationship. So, like, he is a pretty important... character. I didn't like Lewis's hair, the blondie hair, and I was like, that's some shit wig. And then you look at that guy's actual hair and that's his actual hair.
Oh, they couldn't get him to wear a wig.
Could have fucking shaved his head for that money. But yeah. I think that this movie is a definite must watch, like, for the special effects, for the story that's in it. Like, if you don't like aliens, if you're trying to get your girlfriend to watch it, you know, because it looks like she likes the Goonies.
She'll love it because it'll turn out to be a love story.
Absolutely. There's everything for everybody in this.
There's sadness and misery and love and reconciliation and love triangles. It's like, I don't want to say Notting Hill or something like that. It's a chick flick with aliens in a way.
I do think so. There's a lot of resolutions. There's no dark, like... you know, foreboding. There's a little bit of suspense at the start when you have like the alien arms reaching out and kind of grabbing lads, and you're like, oh, what's going on here? But there's a resolution to everything, and it does have both sides of action and the loveliness.
And like that was
which is real. It's real people. Like, what would really happen if really exactly like a 12-year-old boy will use any excuse to try and get a girl to like fall in love.
Spend most of his life learning how to edit video and audio on podcasts to try and impress girls. I think that's because for me, I kept skipping over it and just been like, yeah, whatever, I don't want to watch it. And it was Super 8 and I didn't even know what it was about and no idea what it was. And then just was like, oh, this is... I was annoyed at myself for having not watched it earlier or seen it in the cinema.
Yeah, I think the cinema, it missed a lot of people in the cinema.
Yeah.
2011, J.J. Abrams hadn't really got his full chops yet. He had done stuff like...
He'd done
like episodes of stuff.
No, yeah, he'd done Lost and
episodes
stuff
of Alias. Did you know he even directed episodes of The U.S. Office?
Some of the
darker episodes, absolutely. He directed What About Brian? I remember Felicity, the one with the lawyer with the curly hair. A few of those. He did Lost. Then he did like a whole bunch of episodes. He was the executive producer and director of some of them. Like, he had a big hand in Lost.
Yeah.
And that kind of cemented his career. He got to meet a lot of people through that.
Yeah.
And because it won so many...
I never
so many awards
Lost.
And stuff. Oh, Lost, man. And it still stands up. I've watched it like recently, like 2 years ago.
I couldn't get into it.
Go jump into it now.
There like, was you like have a bit clouds, of time off. Black clouds, and there was polar bears.
But it all
like,
works. Nah, it all right. works, man. I'm telling you, go back, like, power through the first season.
Okay.
And you'll be in.
Okay.
Second season is great. A lot of people don't like it. Get into it. And he had a load of, it's basically TV credits. This is his first proper movie, 2011. Then he was handed that same year the Mission Impossible sequel, Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
Smashed it.
Yeah.
Got Simon Pegg on board.
Yeah.
And then Simon Pegg and him had a long-lasting friendship and great personal relationship. Simon Pegg ended up being Scotty then in the new Star Trek films. He did Star Trek and then Star Trek Into Darkness and Almost Human, the TV, the cyborg TV show. You can get that on Netflix now as well. He was the executive producer right. and director of some of those from the first season.
Mm.
And he did the one Revolution, which is the post-apocalyptic regeneration of humanity village TV show. He did another Mission Impossible. Then he's doing the episode 7 of Star Wars. Like, he's handed Star Wars. Cloverfield. He did a TV series 11/22/63, which we talked about on Those Conspiracy Guys, about JFK and starring James Franco. Went back in time to try and stop JFK getting killed. He did 103 episodes of Person of Interest with Jim Caviezel.
Sorry, go back to that one about stopping.
Have you not seen that one?
I think I saw the pilot for that. Is that when it's in a cafe?
He starts in a cafe and
goes back in time.
The cupboard in the back brings him to a certain point in
and
time.
And if people notice some shit starts happening, it draws too much attention. I love that.
The past tries to stop him from changing the past.
Was that a series?
Yeah, six
episodes.
I saw
the pilot episodes.
Watch it, man.
Oh, no, because I've been waiting for that to come out. I saw that in the cinema, like one of those media junket days.
Yes.
And I just thought...
Fucking whopper.
It was amazing.
I think some of it's written or produced at least by James Franco and that crowd.
Yeah.
But, like, it's down to, like, the fucking material they make in the bow ties and shit like that. Immaculately made. That's really,
really
well done.
I really enjoyed that. I didn't think I was going to like it. And then I was oh, wow.
James Franco in it's based on a story by Stephen King. And he infests the life of Lee Harvey Oswald and goes through all that.
Yeah.
It's fucking whopper, man. Like, 11/22/63. He did Star Trek Beyond. Then he produced that. Doing America Divided. He's the fucking executive producer on Westworld. Like, this lad is like top 10 hits. Like, bang, 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 bang. The stuff that's coming up now is The Last Jedi. I think that's episode 9. Is that right?
That would be correct, I think.
Right. Episode 8. Because
the episode 9 is in pre-production apparently right
it's
now.
Not,
2019.
It hasn't been named yet, but it's episode 9 he got put on because people were messing with it. He has the new Cloverfield. He's the new Mission Impossible. Like, this boy can't do any wrong. Like, he is fucking reinventing our... I'm waiting for a Goonies reboot. I'm waiting for something like... Like, he could literally give... I would trust him with anything from my childhood to make into a... Yeah, absolutely. Because he has it. He knows exactly what it needs. He sprinkles a bit of love on it. Like, this had nothing but love in it.
Yeah, yeah.
This was a fucking... This was like a... a love letter to Steven Spielberg and the 80s. Like, it was,
yeah, it definitely was.
All the best bits of all of those things, all the like the familial relationships and tenderness, as well as like explosions, like the explosions,
explosions and aliens.
That first episode of Lost, when the plane explodes and all, that was like tiny budget compared to this, and you can see with the technology and everything that's advanced, like how good the first 15 minutes of this looks with that train crash. You're like, fuck. Brilliant, you know. So if we had, like we like to do on Why Press Play, if you had one reason why, Cormac, that you would get people to watch this, what would it be? What would your one reason be?
The one reason is that for me, it's very much real life, and it's real life, genuine, and not overloaded with CGI bullshit. And for its story, you get that very rarely with the type of content it's dealing with. So it's the E.T. meets Goonies, and it's my one reason is because you can enjoy the story, and it's just not overloaded with all that CGI shit, which too many movies these days are.
Awesome. My one reason why would be quite similar, in that it concentrates more on the relationships between the people, and it's not focused on the monster and how cool to make the monster look. It's like how the people react to each other and how the relationships are based between the kids, who are the real stars of the show.
Yeah, definitely. Man, they're amazing performances by all of them. Absolutely. They're really, really good.
Yeah. Elle Fanning is...
She's brilliant.
Bring a tear to a glass eye. And Joel Courtney, who plays Joe, but especially Riley Griffiths. Like, I want to look, see where that kid is now. What he's going to be
Kyle
in
Chandler,
the future.
They should reboot the early edition series.
Absolutely.
With aliens. The alien drops the newspaper, go forth.
It'll just be Trump on the front cover
every
day.
It would actually be,
it'd just be like Kyle Chandler living with Donald Trump, stopping him from doing all the stuff from tomorrow.
God, Donald.
Oh, Dan. So that's it for this time on Why Press Play. That was Super 8, directed by J.J. Abrams. A movie from 2011.
Mm.
A definite thumbs up for me.
Oh, definite thumbs up. Why Press Play? Just go Press Play.
Go and watch that shit on Netflix. It's on Netflix now. If you're listening to this in the future, it was on Netflix. Where were you? But I'm sure you could find it on some kind of a website somewhere. Don't say nothing. Not promoting piracy, but I'm sure you could watch it someplace. If anything in the show we brought up, it was incorrect, or we brought up a talking point that you want to talk more about, you can get on to us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest. We have a Reddit over there, r/YPressPlay. And we also have a Discord server where you can get in and have the chats with other people as well as me. Make sure you subscribe to us on YouTube, on VidMe, on Twitch.tv. We'll be streaming and uploading videos to there. Maybe not so much on YouTube, but definitely on VidMe and Twitch. YouTube are gone a bit odd. And if you did like the show and you want to support it, head over to patreon.com/YPressPlay and drop a $2 there. You get loads of extra stuff like outtakes from the show, pictures of my weenus, that's the skin on my elbow, and you also get early access to all the episodes and to the videos that we're going to be putting up on Twitch, as well as exclusive access to live shows and early access to videos from streaming games from PS4, Steam, and some of the old Mega Drive and SNES games as well. So subscribe to this, leave a review on iTunes if you don't mind. I don't really care, but iTunes seem to like it now with this new iOS 11 that seems to bump us up to the very tippy top. I'd like to thank Cormac Moore.
No, thank you very much for having us on.
Absolutely. You can find Cormac at Cormac Comedy
at Cormac
Twitter.
Comedy on Twitter and Instagram,
and for his podcast Project 10, which is taking interviews from people all over Dublin, Ireland, indeed the world, and talking about some of the issues that are happening in society today. It's good crack. It also takes a little bit of a... It's not too serious. Doesn't take itself too seriously. But there is some serious talk going on, and something to really scratch your brain if you want to get into that. That's at Project 10.
Project10podcast.com and at P10podcast on all the social media profiles, Twitter,
so
Instagram.
P10podcast.
Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Love it. So get over on that. And it's also on iTunes or anywhere you get podcasts.
Usual places, yeah.
So thanks for listening. This has been Why Press Play. Goodbye.